Unless I'm a grateful alcoholic. Boy, this is so scary. I don't even ever know why I say yes to do this. I always think I'm so flattered when someone calls. You know, I think, oh, I'm so wonderful. And then I got here and I think, oh, my God. I'm not. I'm wonderful after all. It's really, really nice to be here. I want to thank the committee for asking me to come. The speakers, Mark, me, X, we call him X. His name's actually Xavier. Sean, were involved in Hickey Paw many, many years ago. And so it's kind of like an old home week for a lot of us. I have moved to California, and I've been there for about 4 years now. And, you know, I don't miss the humidity. There's a lot about Houston that I don't miss. But I had a friend one time, not long ago, ask me, do you miss Houston? And I said, you know what I miss? I miss my life there. I miss the longevity, the long-term friends that I have had. I miss my roots here. It's all, it just feels like home. So it's just really, really, really nice to be here. Mark was talking last night about when he sobered up and about Stan the Van Man. And that was really, you know, my sobriety date is January 4th of 1981. And that I had 4 years sober and started getting involved in service work. And Stan and I and Rob H. used to drive into meetings for the Mid-South Regional Conference. And Stan, you just never knew if you were going to get home safe or alive. But I do miss him. And it just really touched me when Mark was talking about all of that. It really took me back to my early sobriety here. Like I said, my sobriety date is January 4th of 1981. I'm from Laverne, California. It's somewhere, I think it says I'm from Ontario. Some people apparently thought I was from Canada. But you know, you should only say that when you're in Europe because they don't like Americans. Just say you're Canadian, you know. I flew out of Ontario. The airport in Ontario, California, is very near my house. And so I think that somehow that's where the idea got started that I'm from Canada. But I'm not. I'm from California. Which is never, I would never have chosen L.A. as a place that I was going to go. I knew I wouldn't stay here in Houston forever, and I kind of thought that I would go back to Arizona, where I spent most of my high school and growing up, and did almost all of my drinking there. And I thought, you know, all the women in my family are single, and if you knew them, you would understand why. And one of the reasons is that they love alcoholic men, but they usually like them when they're drinking, so they can kind of whip them into shape. So they're all single, and I thought, you know, I don't have to stay here. I can go back to Phoenix, and I can do that whole Golden Girls thing, you know, with my sister and my aunts, and we can all, like, I don't know, live in the same house or something. I don't know. We used to talk about we were going to start the old aging AA trailer park when we all got old and were single, and we sit around and talk about who we all slept with, you know. That's a good start, isn't it? Okay, so then I met this wonderful man and got married, and he's from California, so that's how I ended up there. I got sober in 1981. I was 24 years old. I'd been drinking for about 11 years. I started drinking when I was 13 years old, and it was the cure. It was all the promises that are in the big book. That's what alcohol did for me. It took away my fear of people. I, of course, intuitively knew how to handle situations. And it doesn't say that you're a better driver in the big book, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, when I was drunk, I was a better driver. But it basically, what it did was it made me taller. I wasn't shy anymore. It was easy to talk to people. And somehow I fit in, because I never, ever felt like I fit in. About a month ago, I had a girlfriend ask me to talk to her son, who just turned 18. And he's beginning to have some problems with alcohol, or the family's beginning to notice them. He may have had them for a while. So we met at a meeting. She's taken him to some meetings, and he and I sat outside and talked. And he talked about how hard it is for him to be in school and how hard it is for him to have friends. And so I'm talking about I'm telling him my story a little bit. And he says, well, are you telling me that I'm alcoholic? And I said, I would never presume to do that. Let me just tell you what some of the symptoms were. And finally, he looked at me and he said, you know what, though? My life is better since I started drinking. And I thought, okay, you know, there's nothing I can say to that, and there's probably nothing that I should say to that, because I understand exactly what he's talking about. My life was better when I started drinking. That I didn't, I somehow fit in. And I, like I said, I never did feel like I fit before. When I was 15, I lived in Arizona. I was born and raised in Wyoming, but we moved to Arizona. And what we used to do is we used to go out to the desert and party, have big, you know, desert parties. And we'd meet next to the high school. And back then, a quart of beer cost 50 cents. And so you'd give the oldest looking guy your 50 cents, and he could go buy beer for everybody. And so, you know, you'd get your quart, and then we'd all go out to the desert, and everybody was fine. I wasn't, because as soon as I finished my quart of beer, I didn't have any more beer. And I just made me so mad. And there was this thing inside me that said, I want more, and I'll kill you to get it. And I didn't understand what that was. I didn't understand that that was abnormal. I didn't understand that that was obsession. I didn't understand that was I didn't understand any of that. I had no idea. And I began to, I got through high school. I went to college for a little while. And I turned into a blackout drinker. I went to Flagstaff and turned into a blackout drinker when I was probably about 18 years old. I began to have blackouts. And so that's where I am. I'm a bar drinker. I never really drank much at home. And somehow I think I had an idea in my head that if I didn't drink at home, that made all of this, it made it social. It made my drinking social. But if you drank at home, then, you know. I didn't count the drinks that I had before I went out. Or later on, many years later, I didn't count the drinks that I had when I got home. Because at one point, what I had to do was stop somewhere along the line so I could get home, and then I had to go home and finish the job. And so I didn't count those either. When I was, I think, about 23 years old, and one of the things that I used to do was I worked in the bars. So I was a bartender, which is a really good job if you're an alcoholic to have. Unless ABC comes in and, you know, catches you drinking on the job. I used to work for what we call the season in Arizona, which is all winter long, and then I would leave and I would travel around for all summer and then I'd come back. And so in the last year before my drinking, I left. And I used to say that I spent a year traveling, which, you know, sounds really independent and all. I was homeless for years, what happened. But we didn't have homeless people then. You know, this is like 23 years ago. And I lived in my car, and my little Datsun B210 or whatever that thing was, and I drove it from here to Chicago to California up the coast and back, and so I lived with whoever I met, if they would let me stay, and I just basically lived in my car. What I did was I told my family that I was just going to Houston. I lived in Phoenix, that I was going to go to Houston for a couple of weeks. And I never came back, and I never paid another day's rent. I left the house full of furniture as if I was coming back in 15 or 20 minutes. And my cat had just had a litter of kittens, and I left all of this in the house. And it didn't dawn on me that there was something wrong with that. It never occurred to me there was something wrong with that. I had been running for years from myself, and I didn't understand why I hated my own guts. I hated me more than anybody else on the planet, and I didn't know why. I had some ideas why, but it's this horrible circle that I got into. Why do I hate myself? Because I drink. Why do I drink? Because I hate myself. And on and on and on. It was a trap I couldn't get out of. I tried therapy, and so there was, you know, some help happening there, but I heard a friend say one time, you know, the church has the love, but not the words that we need. And the therapists have the words, but not the love that we need. Alcoholics Anonymous has both. So I was able to get some help by going to therapy. The other things I did were, you know, I quit doing drugs because I thought that was a problem. And I started, you know, a lot of physical exercise. I went running every day, two or three times a day, because I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And my conclusion finally was that I was just crazy. What I hoped was that I could somehow manage a level of being functionally crazy, where, you know, I could hold a job, and you would never really rip me off for being just completely wacko. So I'm a runner. That's what I do. I run from things. I run from people. I run from responsibility, and I run from situations. Now, that's not true anymore, obviously. But that's what I did. I loaded up my car, and I moved to Beverly. Now, that's not true either, but it sounded good. I loaded up my car, and I hit the road, and I didn't go back until I had just a little over a year sober. And my aunt had to clean all that up. She had to go into that house. She had to get out those animals that had turned wild. I mean, I don't even think she knew they were in there. She had to pack up all of my things and put them in storage for me. And so needless to say, my family was just incredibly angry at me, and with good reason. I was in, I kind of landed in Chicago for a while. And a friend of mine, I was staying with a friend, and he had a drawer sort of cleared out for me. And I could not get my clothes out of the suitcase and in that drawer. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. I stayed there for a couple of months, but I was ready to go. I used to say, I sleep in my tennis shoes. What happened was, during that time, this friend of mine had been sober for 3 years in AA. And so he never really would take me to a meeting, because I said, well, I was interested because he was involved in AA. And so he told me two things about Alcoholics Anonymous, that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, and that if you wanted to, you could sit in a meeting, never say a word, never. You could sit in the back and never say anything. Now, at the time, I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol, because I thought first of all, if you people would just act right, I wouldn't have to drink the way I drank. Secondly, I could say no to that first drink. I could say no to the first drink, because I knew that after I started drinking, it was going to be horrible, it was going to be unpredictable, and nobody knew what was going to happen. And somehow, being able to say no to the first drink fed my denial. During this time that I was in Chicago, I wasn't really drinking. I mean, I think maybe I was, you know, drunk twice. And what happened was, during Christmas of that year, I left Chicago and I went back to see my family. And during that time of not drinking, I crossed over that line where I no longer had any control. I crossed over that line where I could no longer say no to that first drink. And I went back to Phoenix, and I was drunk, completely drunk, for 3 weeks, a three-week binge. And I didn't draw a sober breath. I couldn't go but a few hours without a drink. And I had no idea what had happened to me. I didn't understand that the disease progresses even though we're sober or we're abstinent. I believe today, you know, for a long time I thought if I picked up another drink, I would be where I left off, which is scary enough to me. But because of my experience, because I crossed that line when I wasn't drinking, I understand now that I'm 23 years sicker in that sense. That if I picked up a drink today, I would be 23 years advanced in my disease. And that just absolutely terrifies me. I went back to Phoenix, and I woke up, I think the night before I got sober, I was at a party, and my drink was like a big water glass just full of vodka. And I think the glass, I thought, gave me dignity or something. I should have just drank it out of the bottle, I suppose. But so I'm at this party, and everybody goes outside. It's January 3rd. Everybody goes outside because somebody's shooting off fireworks. Well, I didn't go outside. I walked around the room and I drank everybody's drink in that room. And I don't know what I thought I was going to say when they came in and said, who drank all these drinks? I don't know. So they come back in. I don't even know if anybody said anything. I went in the kitchen and I looked at my friend Al, who's like 6'6". And I said, I need another drink. And he said, don't you think you've had enough? And I thought, I'll effing kill you. I'll kill you. And I just stood there and looked at him, and he said, oh, let me pour that for you, you know. And I don't remember really much after that. I don't even know how I got home. I woke up the next morning in a hell that I had never, ever known before, ever. I never thought I had a problem with alcohol. I thought I had a problem with you. And with you. I had enough. Like I said, the women in my family liked their men drunk. And I had an uncle who had been just a raging alcoholic. I mean, he beat me all to hell. And he had been sober for, I think, 4 years. And I told him, I said, I have this friend, I'm living in Chicago, I have this friend who is in AA. Could you bring me some literature about AA? Not for me, because my friend is in AA and I want to be supportive. I mean, I sincerely believe that. So they didn't bring me any general literature, you know, this is AA. He brought me Letter to a Woman Alcoholic in AA for Women. And I was so insulted. And I put it on the headboard. And that morning, January 4th, I woke up and I read those pamphlets. And it was my story. And nobody could have been more surprised than me that it was alcoholism. I didn't have a clue. I had no idea. But I remember, and I have read those pamphlets since, and I can't pinpoint to you, I cannot tell you what it was in there that so touched me. But something in there obviously did. And I laid in bed, and I looked up at the ceiling, and I said, you're kidding me. Alcoholism? And it was like God said, as a matter of fact, it is alcoholism. So, and we were talking at dinner tonight. I forgot what I was going to say. I'm so sorry. So what I did was I called AA, and I got this woman on the phone, and I said, and I probably drank a bottle a day, or what is it, fifth or a quarter, some damn thing, I don't know. We make them up. A case of vodka a day. You know. And I said to this woman, well, I don't drink that much. And she said, well, I did. And she proceeded to tell me her story. And I was at my grandmother's house at the time, and because, of, you know, I was homeless, so I had to stay somewhere. And she said, do you want us to send somebody out to talk to you? And I thought, no. So I asked her where the meetings were, and she told me where there was a meeting that night. So I decided to go. There was a man speaking that night. He had 7 years sober. His name was Sam. And in Phoenix, if you have a pulse, they applaud for you. You know, they who has 30 days sober? Who has 15 or whatever? And they just applaud. And it's such a warm, wonderful welcome. And so I sat there, and they, you know, I stood up, woo, and they clapped me in. And so Sam starts to tell his story. And he's talking about things, and we're laughing about things, that I thought I was the only one who had ever done those things, or said those things, or more importantly, felt those things. And what was really wonderful was that there was a name for what I was. I was an alcoholic. And I was, I hate to say it, I was something, you know, I was something, alcoholic. And I thought to myself, you know, this girl asked me, she said, are you going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days? And I said, well, I'm kind of busy. You know? Not working, no place to live, but a little busy. So I kept, you know, those first 3 days were absolutely crucial. I had no money at all. I had like $5 to my name. And everybody kept talking about this big book. So I went to the central office, and I spent my last $5 on a big book. And I still have the receipt. And that, to me, that last, you know, Alky's last five, that I spent it on a big book, to me says nothing about me and everything about you. Because when those first few days, I was coming to these meetings, and people would look me in the eye. And I, of course, I couldn't look them back in the eye. I had to, you know, look down at the floor. But everyone was kind, and everyone was warm, and they told me to come back. And nobody had said that in a long time. I walked into, and you know how your mood when you're brand new, up, down, up, down. I hate you, I love you. I hate you, I love you. You know, it's just, you move. And it's like a roller coaster ride. It's like a Texas cyclone, you know. That, to me, was what my early sobriety was like. Only did cyclone fun, and that wasn't really, you know, so much. But I walked into this meeting, and I was just in such a, oh, such a bad place. And this woman said, "Hi, Lois, how are you?" And I thought, oh, my God, she remembered my name. Oh, my God. So they gave chips at every meeting there, and they gave 24-hour chips. But I was sober, like, 48, so I didn't think I could have a 24-hour chip. So I just sat there, although I really wanted one. At the end of that meeting, we stood up, and she asked me to say the Lord's Prayer. And I went from being down in the dumps and sad to just absolutely elated. Because nobody had even looked at me in years. Nobody had even really spoken to me in years or recognized me or seen me in years. And you did. And so that's why I came back. I didn't know anything about sobriety. I had, even though I had stopped drinking sort of for that 6 months, it was not really a concerted effort. I was afraid this friend of mine would, think I was wacko if I drank, so I just tried not to. But years previously, I had a girlfriend we used to drink together a lot, and one time we did slightly discuss whether we might have a problem, and so we thought, well, let's not drink. Let's try not drinking, and that lasted one day. So I came in here, and I thought, well, I quit one day one time, so I could probably do one day at a time. And I thought, all right, now that maybe I could do. And I kept going to meetings. And I'd get up, and I don't even know why I went to meetings. And I would be driving to the meeting thinking, nothing has worked before. I would read the self-help books, and I would get like a little three-day, ooh, I'm going to change, and then back to the bar. And I tried the therapy, and I tried exercise, and obviously I tried lots of geographical cures. I kept thinking if I just go to a different city, this will be different. Nothing worked before, but somehow, as if by magic, I got in my car, and I drove to a meeting, and I always felt better when I left. But I still didn't think AA could touch my insanity. I thought, yeah, okay, so I probably have alcoholism, but there's something really bad wrong with me on top of that. I mean, truly I'm a garden variety alcoholic, but I did insane things, and so I thought I was insane. So I thought, okay, probably AA can fix me like maybe skin deep, and that ought to do it, because all I wanted to be able to do was function. I honestly didn't think that my insanity could be turned to sanity. I didn't think that AA could fix me down to my bones. I just didn't believe that. So this was going to have to be good enough for me. Skin deep was going to have to be okay, as long as I could, as long as I could function, as long as I could maybe work somewhere. I thought, well, that would be all right. I went back to Chicago, and somebody's going to have to give me the high sign about when to stop, because I didn't look to see when I started. all these hands go up. Stay down now. Thank you. I went back to Chicago. I sold my car, and I thought, I have to get out of Phoenix. It's a horrible town. So I went back to Chicago, and I was so proud that that somebody had told me what was wrong with me, that this is how I got on the airplane. Hang on one second. Like this. I walked to my seat like this. I wanted everybody on that plane to know I was something. I was not nothing anymore. I was something, and it's an alcoholic. I messed up your stack. I'm sorry. I sat down, and I thought, okay, so I had read the doctor's opinion, which is my favorite part in the big book. And I thought, all right, so go through your drinking career. If you're not sure you're alcoholic, go through your drinking career. And so I started from when I was 13, and how alcoholism or alcohol cured me. And I went back to when I was 15, and the book had talked about that obsession and the compulsion and the desire, and I saw that I had that when I was 15 years old. And so I kind of walked myself mentally through my drinking career. And when I got to that day, sitting on that airplane, it just sort of fell on me like a ton of bricks. I thought, you're alcoholic. That's what you are. And in a court of law, you wouldn't even get to testify. You know, you would just be completely convicted of being an alcoholic. And that was the beginning of my admission that I was alcoholic. It was not the beginning of my acceptance that I was alcoholic. That began a year later. I got to Chicago, and I started, you know, going to meetings, and I'm in this meeting. Now, I'm a smart person. I really am. I mean, I can read and write, and I'm a writer. I mean, but you know how you're pretty stupid when you sober up. So I'm in this meeting, and I happened to say I'm looking for a job. And this girl came up to me afterwards, and she said, listen, I'm in greeting cards, and I need help, and come to work with me. So I thought, I could probably do that. So during the day, what we did, my first day, we rode that bus around Chicago, and we went to drug stores. She worked for one particular company, and she would go to this section where her greeting cards were, and last week, if there were 10, this week there were 4, she put 6 back. And that's what we did all day. And at the end of the day, I said to her, it's too hard. I swear to God, I don't understand what you're doing. And I can't work for you anymore. So I did what I always did, and I ran. I packed up my stuff and my family. A lot of my family members were in Houston. And so I came to Houston and, went to meetings at the old Houston Western Club. About 90 days sober, I decided I probably wasn't an alcoholic and that a glass of wine probably wouldn't hurt me. And I wasn't going to a lot of meetings. But a woman sort of took me out. I mentioned that to a woman who later became my sponsor, and she took me out for coffee, and she said, have you ever had a blackout? Because that's one of the symptoms of alcoholism. So I had to think back, and somehow talking to her helped me to understand that I couldn't have a glass of wine, that was just crazy. But what happened as a result of that was I made a decision. Like the Big Book says, we make many resolutions, we don't make a decision. I made a decision right around 90 days sober that I wanted what you have. And so that was really, at that time, the beginning of my sobriety. At about a year, I had somehow, I don't know what happened, but I had to get into acceptance about my own alcoholism, and I was enraged that I had this disease. And I wasn't able to really be social, have friends, go to, you know, have a home group, any of those things. I did have a sponsor, a man, who just took wonderful care of me. So what I did instead of people was I turned to God. God was my best friend, and I went to God for absolutely everything. And I would get on my knees at night, and I would say, look, you bastard, I don't know why you gave me this disease, but I'm really mad that you did, and I don't like it, and I hate it, and I will probably never say that I'm a grateful alcoholic, like I hear people saying. You know, I'm probably not ever going to be a grateful alcoholic. And so, and thus was the real beginning of I think, emotional sobriety, because just over continuing to go to meetings and continuing to talk about feeling like that in those meetings, that somehow I began to accept the fact of my disease. I worked through the steps and, you know, right about the first year. And in year 2, I got married like you do, you know, because... if you know what I thought? When there's no more fun to have, and obviously if I'm not drinking, there's no more fun to have, I'll just get married. So I did, and that lasted, you know, for like 20 minutes. It actually lasted for, I think, 15 months, but I wound up in Conroe, where I met Stan the Van Man, and started getting into service work. We got involved in the Mid-South Regional Conference, Young People's Conference, and I co-chaired it the second year. It was here in Houston, and I think that was maybe 86 or something. And I was the co-chair, which is really the position where you don't have to do anything. You don't have to really stick your neck out. You don't really have to lead much. You can kind of follow the chairman around. And that was my preferred position, and pretty much always has been. And somehow I got voted onto the advisory council for Mid-South. And I would sit in those advisory council meetings, and those people knew everything about everything, and I knew nothing about anything. And I was supposed to be participating, and I was supposed to be you know, stand-up person, and I was absolutely terrified. When I was in school, I could hardly speak in school, and they would send my report cards home and say, needs to speak up in class, too shy, just too shy, which is one of the things that alcohol cured. And I remember we went to Arquipaz as Mid-South of the Advisory Council. I had to go to Arquipaz one year, and my boyfriend at the time, after we finished our business at Arquipaz, were driving home, and I'm sobbing because I cannot speak in these meetings. I'm so terrified I can't speak. And so that changed. I did Mid-South for a number of years, and then I started hanging out with Mark I and got involved with the Houston Young People's Conference. And I think I got involved in the third year. I was a chairman for a panel, I don't really remember. But one of the things that we did that year was we had a lip sync contest. And Darren was our MC, and he dressed up as the church lady. And he did borrow one of my slips for underneath his dress, and he never gave it back. Not that I would have wanted it back, I promise you. But Darren was the church lady. Now, I have to tell you, that particular year, the ballroom was packed. And I think maybe there were, I want to say 700 people. There was 1,000 people were there. And Darren is being the church lady, and he's lifting up his skirt like this, and he has no underwear on. So we're thinking, oh, God, Darren, because one of the things that we're trying to do is get some credibility, you know? And he wasn't helping matters. And because, you know, people, and this happens today, people call up GSO, people call up central office, and they say, who are these young people? Are they AA? And so we're trying to make a good impression and be responsible, and, you know, Darren's like flashing all the people who were there. He claimed he didn't know he was doing it, but. So then we have this lip sync contest, and one of the acts was a guy named Cozy, who dressed up as Batman when that movie Batman came out. Well, Cozy, which we didn't know at the time, was a stripper. And he wasn't in the program, but somebody recruited him to come do this dance. We had no idea. So he's dancing around as Batman. He runs off the stage. He runs back on, and he's got a G-string on. And Batman stickers on his butt. And I swear to God, and Bob W. is back here running the smoke machine screaming, more smoke, more smoke, light it up, more smoke. And we were absolutely mortified. And we had no idea, the ballroom like emptied, you know. We had no idea who to apologize to. It was just, now it's, you know, a funny story, but oh God, back then we were pretty embarrassed. Because we were trying so hard to, you know, act right, do right. The other thing that I got to do with HickeyPaw was there were no bylaws. And so I don't know whose bylaws we got, but we formed a committee to write the bylaws for HickeyPaw. So I got to chair that, and we had the meetings over at my house. And Bob W. and I, God, we fought every, it was like, it was like we were getting in fist fights every single meeting. And then we'd hate each other's guts, and then Mark, I would come in and smooth it all over for us. You know, I've always been convinced that he pitches me out there to start the fight so he can come in and fix it up. I start and you finish it. I also got involved not long after that with Texas, which used to be Texas, Texipaw, which used to be A-Trip and had kind of died out. So we did that for several years. I think, you know, 15 or 20 years I was on that advisory council. And then they decided to have an IckyPaw Big Committee. So I got on that one. And every time I left those meetings, I hated people's guts. Just hated everybody. And I couldn't figure out why. And I finally said, you know what? If you can't play well with the other children, you need to take your ball and go home. You need to just take a break. You need to pick up coffee cups and ashtrays and straighten a few chairs and just leave this stuff alone for a while. So I did. And then we got the conference, and I think Mark called a bunch of us out of retirement. And so I got to be the program chair for IckyPaw when it was here in Houston. And what a wonderful, wonderful experience that was. It was just It was so much fun. And we did that, and there were three of us voted onto the advisory council, and I just rolled off, or we all just rolled off, actually, this year, Marty and Mark and I. 2 years previously, why, I don't know. I stood for chair. And I've already told you, I make a great co-chair, and I make a good vice president. I'm not a leader. And I tell Mark all the time, I'll follow you into hell, but I'll be two steps behind you. You know, I'm not leading the way. But our chairman at the time, Keith H. from Hawaii, said, if you're qualified to stand, stand, and let God sort out the rest. And I knew I was qualified to stand. Supposedly, there had never been another woman chairman of the advisory council, so that I thought, I will never be able to hold my head up or look another woman alcoholic in the eye if I don't stand for this position, if I chicken out, if I do it, no, don't do it out of fear. So I stood and was elected chair. And we had made a lot of changes in the previous year. And so it was up to me to figure a format out to make this thing somehow workable. And it was just the most amazing experience. Like I said, I never thought that I could be any kind of a leader at all, ever. And I would dread going to IPPA because I thought, oh, I have to pretend like I'm smart, and I have to pretend like I know what I'm doing, and I don't know what I'm doing. And I forgot, you know, that the people around us, the people who love us, they've got our back. We're going to be fine. Most of the time I could be a stick. It wouldn't matter who's up front because we know what we're doing. And so when I rolled off this year, the chairman, Tom, we're in Orlando, and he introduced me. And I stood up, and the room stood up and gave me a standing ovation. And I thought, it's never happened before. And you know what? I thought Mark started it. I thought, you know, because I've always been so insecure about my ability to be able to be a leader, that he stood up and everybody else just said, okay. My husband was there, and apparently that's really not true. Mark's not that powerful. And I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to ha-ha-ha friend. I didn't know how to go out to dinner and have a conversation with sort of everybody at the table, because I had spent years having a very quiet little conversation with a person next to me and not really being a part of. And what service work did was it turned me into a social being. I could now be a member of society. And that's what our big book tells us we're supposed to be doing. Is we're supposed to be contributing members of society. This program is supposed to channel us back out there successfully so we can contribute, not take, contribute. And that's what service work did for me. I'm now able to be in a business meeting of a working nature and express my opinion or try to fight for what I want, because y'all taught me how to do that here and how to do it appropriately and how to speak up and how to participate. I learned those things here. I learned all that stuff here. Here's where I learned how to listen to all of our opinions and how to really listen to the most hateful or the angriest people. Because there's probably a thread of truth somewhere in this diatribe that's coming at you. And when you are involved in service work, that's what happens. A lot of people have opinions. So here's where I learned how to give the respect and try to listen to what everybody has to say, and to trust the group conscience, and to trust that process, that we will find the right answer. And if we can't find it, then maybe we need to do some more research, and maybe we need to discuss more, but that the right answer really is out there for us. I really did want to tell you about service work and how important that is, or it was for me anyway. When I was 10 years sober, my mother called me up on my AA sober birthday, January 4th, and she said, I've been sent to the oncologist. And I knew then my mother was dying. And she had been, our relationship was very, very volatile. And it was not getting any better. And I remember thinking, oh, how will we resolve this? I don't know how to resolve this. I can't get closer to her and I can't get away from her. When she said that, all that went out the window. And for 6 months I took care of her. You guys helped me up. And I took care of her in hospital, and my family came in and out, and they were here, but really I was the only one left who lived here. And she died in June of 91, and I picked up my 10-year trip that year. And I said, I'm taking this for my mom. She was always a tremendous supporter of me. I don't know that she ever believed that I was alcoholic because, you know, parents, most of the time, if you say that, it means to them, it means that it's something about them, which we all know is not true. But that's the way our parents have a tendency to interpret that. And so I said, I'm taking this for my mom because even though she never really accepted it or never really believed it, she was my greatest supporter and she always celebrated both my birthdays. And as far as she was concerned, her little girl was okay. She didn't really much care how that happened. And the few times that she really met y'all, she loved you. She said, no one did y'all right. So I took that trip and I took it to her and I didn't, it wasn't about amends, but it certainly was about regret. And so we talked about regret, and I gave her that chip, and she was just so touched. And she said, will you put it in something so I can wear it around my neck? So I got a bezel on. And so my mom is buried with my 10-year chip around her neck. And I can tell you, you're never old enough to lose a parent. There is a certain amount of freedom in being an orphan. There's something good about that, because the rule books out, you know. There's nobody else to get in trouble with now. Because I didn't grow up with a father either. But anyway, so that was the hardest hit I think that I have ever taken, was to lose her. And I thought for a long time, you know, we think we're made out of nails. We're just such incredibly strong people. And I thought, okay, when I get through the grief and all of these things, I'll be back to the shiny new car that I was before. And about 2 years after her death, I looked up and I thought, I might be all right, but every ding, every dent, every scratch, every bruise is still there, and it's still going to be there. And that is that character. So I kind of, that's probably the best I've ever been able to say, okay, I know I'm this kind of a person because of the things that I was able to do with my mom. And so I have to accept that I'll always have those things with me. I'll always have some of those pictures and some of that damage that gets done when you have to walk your parent to the door and open it for them and give them to God. So I'm an orphan and trying to continue to live my life, and I bought a house out in spring, and I began to do a lot of commuting to Washington, D.C. for my work. And I had a girlfriend who kept saying, well, I'm a runner, okay? I pick the guy who's not available. I like the trauma-drama, but I run from relationships. And so I'm going to Washington all this time, and my girlfriend keeps saying, there's somebody here you should date. And I had met this guy a couple of years previously and tried to flirt with him, and he wasn't even remotely interested in me. And he's not in the program at all, which probably explains that. But anyway, she said, no, you should date him. And I said, no, I don't think so. So he came out there, and she kept pushing him at me, and he'd say, she lives in Texas. I said, but she lives in Texas. And my girlfriend would say, but she's portable, you know. She gets the land for her. She can live anywhere she wants. So she kept pushing and pushing. And finally, we got together in Washington, D.C. And we were on our first date in Annapolis, Maryland. And so we dated long distance for a year and a half. I lived here. He lived in D.C. And I think that was probably the only way I was ever going to get to a point where I could be involved in a committed relationship. Because leaving was part of the relationship. That's perfect. You know, whenever it just got too new, I could get on a plane and come back to Houston. And he was an attacher, so he couldn't attach, and then he really had to be on his own up there in Washington. Houston, California, he was on a two-year plane in Washington, D.C. We dated, like I said, a year and a half. And the overwhelming feeling that I had the entire time we were dating was one of peace. Which made me think, I don't think this is love. It's, you know, I swear to God, I thought this can't be love. It's too boring, for one thing. There was no trauma, drama, there was nothing. And my sponsor said, because I've been in these relationships with men you don't want to be there. And I say, you know what, your words are different, but your behavior says you don't want to be in this. Oh, no. And I think, well, I must still be crazy then. And so my sponsor said, this man is a mature man. And if he doesn't want to be with you, you're going to be the first one to know. And I thought, well, thank God for that. So I stuck it out. And one day I was taken, and he was here, and I was taking him to the airport. And I was leaving. He was walking down the gangway, and being very dramatic. And I started to just that convulsively sob, sobbing. And I stopped myself because, I don't want to have a feeling if I can possibly manage not to. Because I am an alcoholic after all. And I thought, what was that? I don't know. I get in my car, and I'm driving out of the parking garage, skimming my way down. And I realized that I was attached to this man way down here in my gut, where we love people. Not up here, where there are butterflies and trauma, and I wonder if he'll call and all that, but way down in here, and I thought, oh no, I love this man, and I had nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. So he asked me where my favorite place was that we had been on our first date, and that we had dated, because we were all around the country working, and, we just kind of made a deal. We'd see each other, every 2 weeks. And I said, in Annapolis, Maryland, where we went on our first date, and we sat waiting for the water taxi to come take us back across the Chesapeake Bay after dinner. And I was looking up at the stars, and he said something to me, and I thought, and I knew, just the way he said it and what he said, I thought, this man would never hurt me. And I said, I think that's my favorite place, sitting out on that dock in Annapolis, Maryland. And so we went out to that same restaurant to celebrate our year dating anniversary, and that's where he proposed to me. And then, oh, it gets worse. And then, ladies, I know. He went out to the dock master, and they pried that bench up off that dock, and he gave that to me for my wedding present. See, all the girls are going, all the guys are going. You gotta step out, boys. He ruined it for all of us. Yeah, so then, the man had proposed to me. He handed me a catalog of all the jewelry, and he said, pick out what you want. And I thought, famous last words, Pally. I'm picking out rings. She got married in April of 2004. We've been married 4 years. This is really not a long time. You think you really know somebody, and, 4 years married, you don't even know if they want mayonnaise on a ham sandwich. You really, it's just so clueless. So we live in L.A., and I have to tell you, it's my friend again, Mark, has called him an Eagle Scout, because he's not a program, he's never been drunk, he smoked, I think, one cigarette one time, because he was in the Air Force, and he heard that you could take a break if you smoked. He thought, nobody else gets a break if they don't smoke, so he tried to smoke a cigarette, made him sick. He doesn't drink. When he's had a hard day, he comes home and he cracks open a Yoo-Hoo. My hand to God. This guy is so straight, you wouldn't believe it. He is absolutely the sweetest, kindest man I have ever, ever met. He is innately kind. I have to work at it. I have to think about being respectful, and I have to think about being kind, and I know that way in there that that's my nature. But I'm also from a family where you are on guard all the time. I'm hypervigilant to the point where if I look at the back of his head, I know something's wrong. And so I have learned to soften up, to be able to begin to trust somebody and to be able to be in a committed relationship. I had said previously to that I just wanted a shot at it. I thought, I don't think I'll be very good, God, but just a shot. And if I'm not any good, it's okay. But I know that I want to learn the lessons that one can only learn in a marriage. Not in a living together, not in a dating, in a marriage. And so I'm having my opportunity now, and I have to tell you, on one hand, it's easier than I thought because I think she makes it easy. I'm the person who, I do tell him, I'll just tell a couple of stories and then I'll quit, I promise. I did tell him that, you know, after we got married, you could never see another woman naked. And he's a cop, so I said, you know, unless he's dead. That's it. And I tried to write in the wedding vows. He kept marking it out. So I had said this with the stipulation of us being married. So we're newly married. We're living in Irvine, California. We're watching TV one night in bed, and we're at first some of the HBO's on, and that show Real Sex is on. And it's like clowns are having sex in a cake or something, you know. And I'm watching this, and I know he's watching it. And I'm thinking to myself, I told him he could never see another woman naked. I tried to get it in the vows, and he wouldn't put it in there. And my mind is going and going, like, what should I do? Should I change the channel? Should I just smack him? What should I do? And I'm not even looking at him. My mind is just... And I look over at him, and this is my husband. That's me. That's why I have to work at being nice. Because I think everybody's a jerk, you know? So, the thing that I've learned, and I really want to share this with you, the thing that I have learned is, you know, when we break up with somebody, we always say, I'm not grieving the loss of him, I'm grieving the loss of the dream. And the dream apparently is, and I've said that myself, the dream apparently is that we will somehow manage to fall into a fully evolved, fully intimate relationship without doing really any work on our own. That somehow this wonderful man's going to come into our lives and this wonderful woman's going to walk in the door and it'll just be magic. And I tell you what, that isn't how it works. That dream is just crap. I mean, it's not even anywhere near true. What I have discovered is that intimacy happens in fractions of an inch. Tiny, tiny bits at a time. And that everybody has to do some work. I thought that this guy was so wonderful, I couldn't figure out. I've always chosen these people. Why am I with this guy? Because, you know, he's perfect. And then finally, some things happened recently, and I thought, oh, same guy, different parents. You know, he's got his ways of being unavailable. But the beauty is, so my point is that he's the same guy I've always dated. I thought for a long time he wasn't, but he is. But what the beauty of this relationship is that he's willing to do the work. He's not in the program, so he doesn't have the same bottom line that we do. I have to do the work because I don't want to be one of those people in AA who draws a line in the sand and says, beyond this point, I will not go. This is good enough. I've seen it, and I don't want that. And a lot of times, those people stay sober for years, but I don't want what they have. And so I have to do my work. But he does it because it's the right thing to do and because he knows that we want a kind of marriage that takes work and takes it takes vulnerability and all of that stuff. So what I have is a partner that I can actually be a partner with. I'm very grateful to be sober. I have to tell you that the meetings in LA are wonderful. I felt like when I left here, it was really time to go. And so I put myself in a boat, and I drifted out into the water. And I was adrift for a long time in California. And somehow, I ran aground at a women's meeting. There's only about six of us. So we have probably over 150 years sober among the six of us. And we meet in a house, this one woman's house, every Wednesday. We have an hour and a half meeting. And I'm crazy about these women. And I asked one of them, we were talking about this earlier, I asked one of them to sponsor me, and she said, no, you really are old enough to have this group sponsor you. And you're going to have to learn how to trust these women to be able to walk in here with your problem, not walk in here with your solution, because that's what I have always done. I want to come back to you and tell you, here's what I did so you'll think I'm wonderful. I don't want to walk in here with any gaping wounds, but that's what I can do in my women's group. So we have a regular AA meeting. We stand up, we hold hands, we pray, we sit right back down. Not always, but if one of us has a problem, all of us will stay, a couple of us will stay, and we work with one another. So they are my sponsor. It's the most amazing experience. I have to say, the meetings in California are so strong and so good, and I have just gotten really, really lucky with these women. And the other thing that I did was I began to have peers, I began to have friends, rather than people I sponsor. Because, you know, if you only have people that you sponsor in your life, who's going to call you on your set? Call me nobody. And that's the way I had set my life up for a long time. So I'm beginning, after 4 years, beginning to settle into California. When I come back from a trip and I drive up, my food, it begins to feel like home, not like this does. And I miss the longevity. I miss the continuity of knowing people for years and years and years. And I'm watching the sobriety countdown, and my friend is standing up with all this sobriety, and I think, oh, God, it's so good to be here. I knew I was dying when I got sober. I knew I would never be 30. I thought maybe I'd get 25. I didn't know what I was going to die of, but I knew I was dying. And I didn't want to. You hear people say a lot of the time, I tried to kill myself and couldn't. And I was killing myself and didn't know how to stop. And so what Alcoholics Anonymous did is obviously saved my life. And you people have taught me how to be a lady, how to have dignity, how to have grace, how to have integrity, and just how to be a member of society. And I owe you my life. Thank you.